This is it.
Level 23.
Final round.
Let's go.
Almost.
Help.
Guys.
All right, I need
more
power.
This is performance enhancing broadband.
Yes.
Whoa.
With the fastest speeds in the most places. For the only broadband made just for gamers. Search EE Broadband, powered by BT.
EE Game Mode requires EE Smart Hub Plus. To verify, see ee.co.uk/claims.
Hey folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and every Thursday we release these special episodes where we look back at content from the earlier years of the podcast. This week, in honor of Pride Month, it's the best of Queer Lives number 2. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Tristan Reese, who in 2017 became a sensation in the news all over for being, quote-unquote, the pregnant man. And he could not be a more beautiful soul to speak to the world about that experience. And we're going to end the episode with the amazing Julio Torres. Julio is one of the most extraordinarily creative voices out there making mind-bending comedy today. His new movie, Problemista, and his new TV series, Fantasmas, are all the rage this year. But first, we're going to hear from Donnie Edwards. I remember so well being behind the curtain backstage in Houston, Texas, listening to Donnie tell this amazing story. I can't remember which story made someone in the audience faint that night, but heck, maybe it was this one. Here's Donnie Edwards now with a story we call Hot Cross Bunny.
I grew up in New Orleans. I'm 8 years old. I'm walking down Bourbon Street to go to my mom's club that she ran, and it was right above Big Daddy's, a famous strip club. And I would always stop and, you know, take a little peek in and see if I could see some tits and ass, you know. Because I knew I was different at 8, just didn't realize how different. So my mom's best friend owned Big Daddy's, and he ran all the strip clubs on Bourbon, and I got to know him, and I got to go in those strip clubs. So when I was about 18, I started hanging out in Big Daddy's, and his son also hung out in Big Daddy's, and he didn't like me because I was gay. Now, Billy was a really male chauvinist, thought he was God's gift to women, and married it, but still running around on his wife, but that's his shit, not mine. But there was a stripper in there named Bunny. Now, Bunny was a beautiful, big-boobed, blonde, blue eyes, just really beautiful woman. She wasn't like the rest of the strippers, you know, those bone girls that just get up there and ride the pole. She really made love to the pole and just really made you want to be a stripper, really. But she liked my little bony ass. Okay, I know I'm not bony now, but I was bony then, okay. So when I was in Big Daddy's with Rick, the owner of the club, and she would be on stage making love to the pole, and she'd be looking at me, and then she'd go, I would turn red, but I would walk over there because I didn't want to disappoint her. And she would crawl across the stage and give me this, I'm gonna fuck you later. And I'm like, ah! And she would back her ass up on me, and then she'd flip her legs over and pull that G-string to the side. And whatever I had in my pocket was Bunny's. So when she would get off stage, she'd come over there and she'd get me, and she'd take me to a little dark corner and tell me all the ways she wanted me to fuck her. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, sure, whatever. Just as long as you're sitting on my lap kissing me, I don't give a shit what you want me to do. So she would finish her thing, and I would go back and sit by Rick, and then I'd tell him I have to go. And I'd run down to the bar down the street and talk to my friend that I grew up with. His name was Tommy, and I'd say, "Tommy, she's driving me crazy." And he goes, "Fuck that shit. What's wrong with you?" And I'm going, "She's a stripper. She's older than I am. I'm a little shy." He goes, "Fuck that shit." He says, "You need to smoke some weed and fuck that shit." And I was like, "Tommy, I can't fuck that chick. I have to fuck that chick." So I smoked some weed with Tommy in the back of his bar, and I went back. I was gonna fuck that chick. So I go back in there, got my confidence up, a little high. She walks over and she goes, "Baby, what are you doing back?" I'm like, "I wanna fuck you." I've come to realize that, yes, I want to. And she goes, "Well, I'm on break. How about Rick's office?" I turn and look at Rick, and Rick goes, "Go for it, kid. What the hell are you still sitting here?" So we go into the office. Now, I don't know if you can tell from these lights, but I'm pretty red right now. And I was pretty red then. She drops her little G-string, and back in the 1980s, they had to wear these ugly Band-Aid pasties on their nipples, and she flopped those off, and I was like, "Ah, the prettiest pink nipples I'd ever seen in my life at 18. So she lays back on this love seat that Rick just so happens to have in his office. Well, I go over there, and I start making out with her. I start fucking her. I make my way down, and I start sucking and fucking her. She's into it because, you know, she's pulling my hair, and I'm like, "Damn, I'm actually fucking an older woman." And she's a stripper, the prettiest one out there. So then she rips off my pants, and I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, I didn't plan this. This was not my fantasy." But anyway, she tries to get me to come, but I'm excited. You know, I can't. So she goes, "Baby, my break's over, and this is taking way too damn long." And I'm like, I'm young. I'm okay. So I go back out there by Rick, and Rick's like, "You need a drink?" And I'm like, "Oh, fuck, yes. Just anything that's liquid, I will take right now." So I drink my drink, and I run back down to tell Tommy. "Tommy, I fucked her." And he's like, "Yes. All my friends want to fuck her too. What do you think the odds of that is?" And I was like, "Whoa, buddy, no, yeah, no, no." So a couple days pass, and I go back down there to talk to my buddy Rick, and hoping to see Bunny. Well, I walk into the bar, and there sits Rick's son, and he has this pissed off look on his face, and I kind of looked at him. I was a little scared, but I'm like, "Man, he's an asshole." So I look at Rick, and I'm like, "What's up?" And he goes, "We kind of have a problem." And I'm like, "Really?" And all of a sudden, Billy starts screaming, "You dyke, you fucked my girlfriend." I'm like, "Yo, dude, I don't know who your girlfriend is. Aren't you married?" And he goes, "No, you fucked my girlfriend, and I watched it. My father has cameras in his office." Yeah, I kind of knew that, but I forgot. So Rick looks at me and goes, I'm like, "Yeah, okay." I said, "Okay, well, I won't fuck her again. Once in a lifetime thing, I'm good with it." And he goes, "Well, I'm not. You're kicked out of this fucking bar." Oh, yeah, that was, I'm like, "No, no, 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 no. I love this bar. I love looking at strippers, so yeah." I was like, "Rick, can he do this? You own this bar." And he goes, just go. I'll fix it." And I'm like, "Okay." So I leave, and I go down, and I tell my friend Tommy, "Fuck, that's Billy's girlfriend." He went, "Oh, shit. What the hell are you going to do?" I'm like, "I don't know. I'm hoping Rick will kind of fix this. I don't have to fuck her again. I'm cool with that. I just really like seeing women naked, and that's a good place to see them naked." And he's like, "Yeah, I like going there too. You always got me free drinks." And I'm like, "Yeah, no more free drinks, fuck." So anyway, Rick sends a couple days. He sends a guy down there to my job and says, hey, Rick wants to talk to you when you get off work. Go down there. And I'm like, cool. So I walk in, and there sits Rick, and there sits Billy, grinning like a chested cheetah. And I'm like, what the fuck's going on here? So I looked at Rick, and I'm like, so how do I get back in the bar? And he goes, well, Billy wants you and him to have a three-way with Bonnie. I look at Billy because Billy's not very attractive. And I don't like penis. And I'm like, okay, this is okay. No. I said, does he get to, no? And Rick's like, oh no, girl, we know you queer, no. Like, it's just you and him fucking Bonnie in my office because he wants it taped. Oh. I'm like, well, that's a little gross, but okay. I'm like, okay, well, okay. I stood there for a couple minutes going, damn, can I do this? Because he is really not attractive, okay? You know, if he looked like Rick, Rick was an older Italian guy, very nicely groomed, very nice looking guy. He was a slob. There's no telling what his mother looked like. So I'm like, so I get my bearings and I looked at him. I said, so, okay, when would you like to do this? And he goes, tonight. And I'm like, ooh, tonight. I gotta get very high to do this tonight. So I looked at Rick and I said, so if I do this, and I look back at him, I can come in this bar. And Billy goes, and you can still fuck Bonnie. And I'm like, yes, this is good. So I'm like, okay, I'll be back tonight. I see you later. So I run my ass home, okay? Because I knew my roommate had X. X is a good drug in the 1980s. Got over a lot of shit when you did X. So I tell my friend I need some X, and she's like, for what? And I'm like, okay, remember I told you I was kicked out of the bar? Well, I gotta have this three-way. And she's like, you are so shy. Really? You're actually gonna fuck a dude? I'm like, no fucking a dude. No, I'm just gonna be in a room with him. And she's like, yeah, okay, you do need some X. So we start drinking, we take the X, and I gotta get on the streetcar and go back to the French Quarter. That's another story. So I get on the streetcar, I wind up in Big Daddy's, I walk in and Rick goes, where you been? They're already in there. And I'm like, fuck. I'm like, okay, this is cool. I open the door and there was Bunny giving Billy head. I'd never seen that shit before. She took him all the way in and all the way out. And I'm standing there going, damn, why didn't God make me a dude? Shit. He looks like this is the best shit that's ever happened in his life. So I'm standing there for a couple minutes and he gives me the, well, that's my cue to fuck her too. So I'm like, okay. So I get down there, I'm eating her, I'm fucking her. And all I can do is look up and watch her give Billy head. And I was pissed. I want a dick. So, yeah, you motherfuckers are, yeah. You know who you are. So then he flips her over. She rips off my little shorts and she's trying again. But it works this time because I got that visual in my head of, I come, everybody comes. And so it's over. Everything ends. And Billy puts out his hands and I shook his hand and he goes, you know, I still don't like you. And I'm like, yeah, well, I don't like you either. And he goes, but this girl right here likes you and my father loves you. So that's the only reason I agreed to this. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Yeah. I got a man to see about a horse. So I walk out there and Rick's sitting there and he's looking at me and goes, so kid, how'd it go? And I'm like, oh, it went okay. And he goes, he didn't touch you, did he? And I'm like, mm-mm. I said, but it was nice. And he goes, really? And I'm like, yeah. I said, but I got to go somewhere. I'll see you later. My ass leaves the Big Daddy's. I go to my first sex shop and I buy me a strap-on. Fuck that shit. If I can't feel it, I'm gonna watch it. So, every Friday night, I got to do Bunny in the office with my strap-on. It was heavenly. Until Billy fired her. And I was like, yeah, that's what I thought. Really? Where am I gonna find another girl to do this? But I did. So, 30 years later, I'm old. 30 years later, I still have a strap. I still get to use it. But I still remember Bunny, though, the first time I ever did it strap-on style. Thanks.
The bunny, whoa, I ate the bunny. I didn't eat my soup or my bread, just the bunny. The bunny, the bunny, oh, I love the bunny.
I don't want no pickles, I don't want no honey, I just want a
strap on to fuck sexy bunny.
The bunny, the bunny, whoa, I ate the bunny. I gave everything that I had. For the bunny.
We'll be right back.
Relationships are hard, and that's why I'm here. Hey friend, it's Cammie Crawford. You may know me from my work on MTV's Catfish, and I hope you'll join me on my show, Relationship, the advice podcast that covers all relationship topics. It's a judgment-free zone, and nothing is off-limits. Think of me as your big sister slash audible BFF that you can always trust to give you the real tea. Listen and follow Relationship with Cammie Crawford, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back.
I'm sitting on my couch in my living room next to my partner, Biff, and there is a gigantic microphone in our face. We're being interviewed for our favorite parenting podcast, The Longest Shortest Time. And we're being interviewed because it's a parenting podcast and we're going to have a baby, which I know is not a big deal. It's how we all got here. But in our case, it is a big deal because at the time of the interview, I was pregnant. This is not a miracle of modern medicine. I'm just transgender. And for me, that means that I was born female. I had a girlhood. At an early age, I was exposed to theater. I know it's shocking. And that was my first interaction with gay people. And I was like, yep. And so the joke became that I was a gay man trapped in a woman's body. And as I got older, the literal feeling of being trapped in the wrong body got more and more pervasive and painful until around age 20, I met a transgender man and I realized it was not a joke at all. I actually was a gay man trapped in a woman's body. And with that realization, of course, came the second realization that I could fix this problem and live a happy life. So I took testosterone and that made me look like I do today, like every other gay dude in Portland. Thank you. And so that's one thing you should know about me. And the thing you should know about my partner, Biff, is that he changed my life. We met when I was living in Los Angeles. I was living my childhood dream of being a professional pissed off queer. Yeah, I was an actual gay rights activist. And at the time, I was working on marriage equality. And I was one of those people that goes door to door and finds homophobic people and tries to change their mind. It is as easy as it sounds. Yeah. There's usually three problems that people have with the gays when you talk to them. Number one, it's against their religion. Number two, it's against tradition. And number three, gay sex is icky. And it turns out that I was really good at having these conversations with these people. I was really good at being patient and open and pleasant and curious. And when they said really hateful things to me that didn't feel hateful to them, I could kind of just roll with it. And so I did that, and I was good at it, but it was really hard internally, because it's hard to hear hateful things all day, every day, as part of your job. And the second reason that it was hard to do that job is because I was pretty sure that I was never gonna get married. Not because I didn't want to, I did, but I didn't know any trans people who were married. I didn't even know any trans people who had relationships that weren't like fighting all the time on Facebook for everyone to see. You know what I mean? And that was when Grindr first started. And what I was hearing mostly from dudes on Grindr was kind of the same stuff that I was hearing from voters at the door, was that I was gross. And so I didn't think that love was really in the cards for me or that I would ever find it. And then I met Biff. First of all, he is the most beautiful person I've ever seen in my whole life. So when I met him, I was just like, holy shit. And there are two kinds of gay dudes, right? There are gay dudes who like dick, and then there are gay dudes who like men. And he was that second kind. He didn't care what I had going on. I mean, he cared, but in a good way. You know what I mean? And the way that I showed up in his mind was that I was perfect. And it was my first time feeling perfect. And all of those voices, those voters' voices, those dudes on Grindr, they all went away. And for the first time in my life, I felt perfect. And we dated, and then we fell in love, and then we adopted his niece and nephew because they needed a place to live, and we had a place. And we did get married. Thank you. And then 4 years after we got married, I started to have dreams about having his baby. Not in the way that people are like, I want to have your baby. I mean, yes, that, but also literally have his baby. And I have a uterus and eggs, and he has sperm. You do the math, you know what I mean? And I know hundreds of transgender men like me who have beards and everything who have successfully given birth to happy, beautiful kids. So I totally knew it was possible. And I went to the doctor and I was like, can I do this? They checked me out and I was explained that testosterone is a little bit like hormonal birth control. It stops ovulation, you stop taking it, and then everything kind of kicks back into gear and you can conceive and carry a child just like anyone else. And I started to be really excited about having a baby and having his baby. And I also started to really be excited about what it would mean to be a pregnant man. Because for me, a lot of what I hear basically is, I will accept you as a man as long as I never have to think about the fact that you are transgender. Which for me, I'm like, is that acceptance or is that coercion? You know what I mean? And so for me, I was like, what if I didn't let people allow me to let them forget that I'm transgender? What if I embraced and accepted the fact that I am a dude, I have a uterus, and I can make a fucking baby, and none of you guys can do that? And no offense, dudes, but like, I don't want to be like you. So I stopped taking testosterone, and I got pregnant. And it was awesome. The end was hard. But like, the beginning parts was awesome. And I felt like we were kind of like in the footsteps of that sacred queer tradition of taking broken shards of glass and putting them together to make a beautiful mosaic. Like, we had taken all these disparate things and we had created a family out of love. And my teenage self, like, really needed to tell this story publicly, which is how I ended up on that couch with the big microphone in my face, because I wanted to tell the story. And the podcast did a really good job. They cut out all the parts where I sounded stupid. And they put it together really nicely, and I thought, you know, maybe a few hundred people will hear this story, and it'll impact them. And the night that the podcast came out, I got an email from Cosmo Magazine. For me, I'm like, that's the big time. You know what I mean? And they're like, can we write a story electronically? And I was like, yes, maybe a few thousand people will hear our story and it'll have even more of an impact. So I was super proud of myself and I like went to bed that night, whoop, Cosmo Magazine. While I was asleep, it was nighttime here on the other side of the earth. It was daytime, and the tabloids were hard at work. So I woke up the next morning and pulled up Facebook, and there is our story on the Daily Mail, which is a tabloid with about 1.5 million readers every day. And there was our story, and there was my picture. And by the time I opened up Facebook, that article had been shared 26,000 times. There were 56,000 comments. I am not a morning person, so I wasn't really thinking clearly. So I scrolled down and I looked at the comments. Where were you guys that morning? really could have used you. They were not good, as you may imagine. A lot of people said that I was not a pregnant man. I'm just a really ugly, hairy woman. A lot of people said I looked like a circus freak, and I'm like, cool, some of my best friends are circus freaks, you know? And then there was a good chunk of people who said that they hoped that I gave birth to a dead baby. Because that baby would be better off than a baby who had to be born to someone like me. And it was like, it all came back. All of those voters and all those dudes on Grindr, and now this whole new group of voices, strangers on the internet, telling me how disgusting I am. And I was 6 months pregnant when I read that comment. And we had to make a choice, Biff and I. We had to decide if we were going to step back and let the tabloids have their way with us, or if we would try to tell our story, keep telling our story, but responsibly. And that's what we did. We partnered with CNN and People Magazine and Washington Post to try and get out in front of it and tell the story the way that we wanted it to be told, about love and possibility. And it worked. We had the incredible privilege of being invited into millions of homes all over America on the nightly news. Actual queer people with piercings and tattoos, one of whom was pregnant. And we heard from people all over, the Midwest, the South, religious people saying I was the first trans person they ever met, and that they never knew that trans people could be parents. We heard from trans youth who were like, thank you for telling me that finally I can tell my mom that she could be a grandmother one day, that I don't have to give up anything if I'm trans. Nothing. And that was really exciting to hear. But in the back of my head, I knew why we had been invited in and other people hadn't. And it's because we are really safe. We look like every other gay couple in Portland, except I was pregnant. We were like sterile and positive and calm, just like I'd been at the door with those voters, right? I could never get angry at the incredibly invasive things that they said. And one time, when we were about to go live for our very first television interview, Biff went to put his hand on my knee, and I batted it away. And I looked at him, and he was so hurt. And we did the interview, and then the lights came down, and he said, what was that? And I had to explain to him what I had learned with those voters, that homophobia and transphobia is a really intense and complicated system of tripwires, and you have to basically be a ninja to get around them, to get to the root, to dismantle it. And I knew if people saw us holding hands, kissing, hugging, touching, that for some people who didn't know what to think about gay people, that was going to be too much, and we were going to lose them. It would feel good to me to, like, kiss this man that I love, but that would be about my ego, not about actually making it easier for the next more controversial, more interesting, more compelling trans person that comes along behind us, and that's what we wanted to do. The other thing we had to do was answer really fucked up questions. Really fucked up questions. People are really obsessed with trans bodies. And I'm like, you know, thank you for the interest, but no thank you. So people really wanted to know if I was going to breastfeed. Like, I got this question all the time. Are you going to breastfeed? Can you breastfeed? Do you know that if you don't breastfeed, your baby's going to end up sickly? Not science, by the way. at all. People want to know what kind of birth I was planning to have, a C-section or a natural birth. I'm sorry, is any birth unnatural? It was completely bizarre. But then my favorite slash least favorite question was, how is the baby conceived? You're asking about my sex life on NBC. What am I supposed to say? Do you know what I mean? And the real reason that I couldn't actually answer that question is because the real story is, like, not safe for work. The truth is, while I was ovulating, Biff was working night shifts, so one night I snuck into his work after midnight, and we fucked in the bathroom at his work. When you've been with someone for 8 years, that shit doesn't happen that much. It was amazing, and, like, not something I can tell Anderson Cooper. Do you know what I mean? So I answered all those questions. I maintained that, like, perfect model trans person demeanor, even though it killed me, all the way up until the day it was time to actually give birth to this giant fucking baby that had taken over my body. And the hospital was super nice, and Biff was amazing, and my dad was there, and Biff's mom was there. And if you had asked me before I gave birth, like, is childbirth a miracle? I would have been like, no, it's science. Then I had a baby. It's a fucking miracle. There wasn't a person there, and now there's a person. You're like a god. It was amazing. It was amazing. And he was just more than I could have ever imagined. And we named him Leo. And after he was born, and I was holding his little body, our friend came and took a little video of us being like, haha, you said two men can't make a baby, watch us, whatever. And then when she left, I knew in my heart that I was done with this whole media stuff, that it was my job now to be a really good parent to this brand new person and to my amazing older kids and a way better partner to Biff than I'd been when I was pregnant. And I just told Biff, I'm done. I can't do Facebook or Instagram or comments or none of it. Done. And he took a deep breath and he held my hand and he said, sweetheart, I love you so much, but no. No. Because if we stop now, then the clickbait, the pregnant man, that's the story. Not our family. Not what comes afterwards. Not this vision that we have for a better world where anybody can get pregnant and feel loved and supported, where anybody can hold hands and kiss on television and not have people turn it off or tell them how fucking disgusting they are. That's the world we're working for, and if we stop now, we're not really helping to get there. And that's why I'm here on this stage today, is because I trust Biff. And I'm telling my story as much as I can for as long as I can, in the hopes that the love that I start to feel from all of you and from this incredible family that we have built from shards of glass can drown out all of that hate. Because as it turns out, nothing is better at driving out hate than love. Thank you.
Did you ever think that your mother used to be a little boy and your dad used to be a little girl? That's right. They were children one time, too.
Daddies are people. People with children. When daddies were little,
they used to be girls like some of you. But then they grew and now
daddies are men. Men with children,
busy with children and things that they do. There are a lot of things, a lot of mommies
and a lot of daddies
and a lot of parents can do.
Hi. Hi. Hello. I wasn't always a star. I was once a just meek little liberal arts college student, as were all of you. I remember that when I graduated school, I went to the New School here in New York. And if you know anything about the New School, this makes sense. When I graduated from the New School, all I wanted was to get a 9-to-5 job that would pay for being alive in New York. That is all I wanted. And I thought, well, I got good grades, so job, here I come. Because I was very smart, but also very stupid. And I thought, well, I have such a great resume, because, you know, during college, I was addicted and obsessed with internships. I couldn't get enough of them. I was just a little internship whore. One was offered to me, and I would say, yes, more internships. I was once an intern for this literary non-for-profit. I would go there, and I would sit, and then I would leave. I was there for 2 years. To this day, I couldn't begin to tell you what they do. It was always a mystery. One day I'd like to know. So I thought, well, I'm ready for a job. So I tried applying. Oh, mind you, I was graduating with a literary studies degree. So I did what I think everyone does, which is, you know, you email any like professor that was ever nice to you, and you're like, hey, So, Julio, I was in your, like, Kafka in architecture class. Just wondering if there are any dogs I can walk. But no, I wasn't quite desperate yet. And I tried for, like, the publishing jobs. I never got an interview. And then I tried just anything vaguely related to what I wanted to do. And someone got me an interview at this place called the Meredith Corporation. Now, I was so happy to get an interview and so confident that the only thing that was stopping me from getting a job was like, oh, they just haven't seen me. You know, once I get the interview, I'll be so charming and they'll just love it and they'll make me the CEO. So I was very cocky and I didn't research what the Meredith Corporation was. So I just showed up and in the lobby, I'm just trying to gather context clues of what this place is. Meredith Corporation, Meredith Corporation, what are you? And then I gather from the context clues that they publish very niche publications that cater to suburban interests. So like gardening magazines and cooking magazines and like Candles That You're Never Light magazine and Potpourri magazine. So I thought, I can do this. I'm very competent. I can write an article for any of these magazines. So I go into the interview, and the first question that the woman asks is, why are you interested in a position in sales? And I fumbled, and I was like, well, I like buying things. So I feel like being on the other side of that would be exciting in the natural progression of my hobby of buying things. And then I could sense that the interview was just becoming worse. It was just bombing the interview. And I was like, oh, Meredith Corporation, what am I doing here? And it was just like, it was just going so badly. And then there was just a pause when we were like, and I, in that moment, thought, I'm going to save this. And then I just said, I love corporations. And I did not get hired. So then, well, then I decided to do something, well, dare I say, risky. Here it comes. You can all guess. I went to the, what's that quote in The Lion King? To that part of the kingdom where the light doesn't... Craigslist. I I went to Craigslist. Mordor from Lord of the Rings. Yeah. And then I was still delusional because I went to the like writing slash editing section of Craigslist. And I thought, well, you know, I might be going to like this scary neighborhood, which is Craigslist, but I'll go to like the nice part in the scary neighborhood. I'll go to the writing editing section. And then I see this ad that says, looking for PG-friendly stories about tickling. And I'm thinking, maybe it's like ghostwriting a children's book. I write back, and I'm like, you know, I graduated from this school, and I can write a story about tickling. Sure. He wrote back, he, of course. The worst stories in life involve a he. And he wrote back saying, okay, so what I'm looking for is fun guys like yourself to videotape yourself talking straight to camera, no nudity, no lewd language, just about how much you love being tickled. And I thought, oh, no, I'm definitely in the bad part of town now. But then it almost felt like a challenge because you should know that I hate being tickled. Maybe I don't hate it, but I think I have the average person's reaction to it, which is, this is annoying. Why is it happening? So I thought, oh, well, what a fun challenge. I think it paid like $100 per 5-minute video. And you're thinking, you're making $100 every 5 minutes? Well, no, because to get 5 minutes of footage that I was satisfied with, that was like a day. So I did the first one. Immediately, I just slip into this all-American guy character. So I just start talking about like, oh, you know, like my big brother, he would just pin me down to the floor and he'll tickle me and he'd be like, huh, I'm the tickle monster. Who's the tickle monster? And I had to be like, oh, you're the tickle monster. But then I just went to college and I got stronger and stronger and I came back home and then I pinned him down to the floor and I was like, who's the tickle monster now? He loved it. And I was so pleased. Because then you think, okay, so like the first one was like set at home, so like the sequel has to be college, right? So the sequel, I was... me and like my buddies, we were gonna join a frat, and the initiation, fuck, it just tickled us all night. And he liked that one. And then I kind of got too ambitious, and I really phoned it in with the third one. It was just about like I was with a friend, and he started tickling me or something like that. Yeah, I got too cocky because then he wrote back saying, this is no longer working for me. I don't know that I'll ever heal from that. So I had to, you know, move on. And then I replied to this other Craigslist ad that said, looking for a magician's assistant. And I thought, well, that's just fun. But my first question I asked in the email, the first and I think the only thing that I asked is, does the assistant have to be female? Or can we just like open our minds and this be like a really like fun thing? Like, can I be the first male? I don't know if I would be the first male magician's assistant, but I was like, oh, maybe I'll get a job and make some history while I'm at it. He writes back like, no, very like choppy sentences. No, that's okay. Meet me for an interview and then like the address of a cafe in Soho. And then I go into the cafe and then I realized, oh, I don't know what this magician looks like. But then I see a gentleman in all black and a fedora. And I think, oh, okay, good. So I sit down with him, and he's with this woman who's just sort of like, her face was just grumpy. She was just like either bored or tired. She was just like, and she, I like said hi to her, and then like we never got introduced, but I never got a name or anything. She was just like there. And the magician, the first thing he says is, "I'm not magician." And it was like, well, uh-huh. Please do go on. And he a little surly, but he's like translating from his native language a lot. So he sounds very pensive and he's just taking his time with every sentence. He goes, "I am not a magician. I am saxophone player." And I'm thinking, well, clearly you know the name for the thing you do. So why not looking for a saxophone player assistant? Like, why are we hiding that you're a saxophone player? That's okay. In fact, I guarantee more and better responses than a magician's assistant. Like, I'm the only one, like, stupid and weird enough to reply to a magician's assistant ad. Or if you're, like, a saxophone player, like, a lot of people wouldn't mind doing that. But he's just like, "I am a saxophone player." I'm like, okay, I have a saxophone. I'm like, uh-huh. Yes. Great, you're not renting. I have a saxophone, and I play at parties. People are laughing, people are having fun, it is a wedding, it is a retirement, it's a birthday, they're having fun, I am playing a saxophone, any song, Madonna. They're laughing, and then dick comes out. I was like, why? You just said that people were already having fun. These people are at a retirement party, you just said. And then dick comes out. It doesn't seem like anyone was asking for dick to come out. And he goes, "No, no, no. I have a special saxophone. I push a button from the hole in the saxophone. Plastic dick comes out. And from the dick, tequila, vodka, and people laugh, they drink." I'm still like a little hung up on like, why magician's assistant? It's just a lie after a lie after a lie. And then his wife interrupts for the first time. She hasn't said anything. She leans over and she sort of like sees me becoming less and less interested in the job. She leans over and she goes, "Only saxophone in the world that can do this." She is, I think, sick and tired of defending this man. He's like, "I believe in him. He made it. The dick comes out. I'm sick and tired of explaining it to everyone what my husband does." And I ask, like, well, what would I do? What do you need me for? And essentially what he wanted was someone to get him booked for parties. And he, I think, wanted to charge $300 or $400 an hour for the saxophone. And then he goes, "But no one can know about Dick. Dick must be a surprise for everyone." So not even the person paying for the service, not even the person throwing the party can know that that will happen. I thought about it for a little bit. Like, maybe I can be the booker. But of course it didn't happen. It was just like yet another job I didn't succeed getting. But that was not my fault. And now I just do this. I just do comedy, which seems so much easier than getting a 9-to-5 job. Like, if you're looking for one, good luck. I don't have any pointers. Just be a star. I feel like now this devolved into a Q&A where no Q was asked. It started like a commencement speech, and now it's a Q&A. Thank you. Thank you so much. Bye.
This is Risk. This is Fleur East behind me now. And we just heard from Julio Torres. His story wasn't really about being queer, but his whole being certainly is. Don't forget to check out Problemista and Fantasmas, both streaming on Max, on Amazon Prime, and etc. Well, that is it for the Best of Queer Lives number 2. And if you've got a story about queering queernesses queerly, pitch us at risk-show.com/submissions. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.